Chapter 15. An Element of Madness. Selenium, manganese, palladium, barium, rentgenium. Robert Lowell typified the mad artist, but there's another psychological deviant in our collective cultural psyche. The mad scientist. The mad scientists of the periodic table tended to have fewer public outbursts than mad artists, and they generally didn't lead notorious private lives either. Their psychological lapses were subtler, and their mistakes were typical of a peculiar kind of madness known as pathological science. And what's fascinating is how that pathology, that madness, could exist side by side in the same mind with brilliance. Author's note, credit for the phrase pathological science goes to chemist Irving Langmuir, who gave a speech about it in the 1950s. Two interesting notes on Langmuir. He was the younger, brighter colleague whose Nobel Prize and impudence at lunch might have driven Gilbert Lewis to kill himself. See Chapter 1. Later in life, Langmuir grew obsessed with controlling the weather by seeding clouds, a muddled process that skirted awfully close to becoming a pathological science itself. Not even the great ones are immune. In writing this chapter, I departed somewhat from Langmuir's description of pathological science, which was rather narrow and legalistic. Another take on the meaning of pathological science comes from Denis Rousseau, who wrote a top-rate article called Case Studies in Pathological Science for American Scientist in 1992. However, I'm also departing from Rousseau mostly to include sciences such as paleontology that aren't as data-driven as other more famous cases of pathological science. Unlike virtually every other scientist in this book, William Crookes, born to a tailor in London in 1832, never worked at a university. The first of 16 children, he later fathered 10 of his own, and he supported his enormous family by writing a popular book on diamonds and editing a bumptious, gossipy journal of science goings-on, Chemical News. Nevertheless, Crookes, a bespectacled man with a beard and pointy mustache, did enough world-class science on elements such as selenium and thallium to get elected to England's premier scientific club, the Royal Society, at just 31 years of age. A decade later, he was almost kicked out. His fall began in 1869 when his brother Philip died at sea. Author's note, Philip Crookes, William's brother, died on a vessel laying some of the first transatlantic cables for telegraph lines. Despite, or perhaps because of, their abundance of family, William and the other Crookeses nearly went mad with grief. At the time, spiritualism, a movement imported from America, had overrun the houses of aristocrats and shopkeeps alike, all over England. Even someone like Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, who invented the hyper-rationalist detective Sherlock Holmes, could find room in his capacious mind to accept spiritualism as genuine. Products of their time, the Crookes clan, mostly tradesmen with neither scientific training nor instinct, began attending seances en masse to comfort themselves and to chat with poor, departed Philip. It's not clear why William tagged along one night. Perhaps solidarity. Perhaps because another brother was stage manager for the medium. Perhaps to dissuade everyone from going back. Privately, in his diary, he had dismissed such spiritual contact as fraudulent pageantry. Yet watching the medium play the accordion with no hands and write automatic messages, Ouija board style, with a stylus and plank, impressed the skeptic despite himself. His defenses were lowered, and when the medium began relaying babbled messages from Philip in the great beyond, William began bawling. He went to more sessions and even invented a scientific device to monitor the susurrus of wandering spirits in the candlelit rooms. It's not clear if his new radiometer, an evacuated glass bulb with a very sensitive weather vane inside, actually detected Philip. We can hazard a guess. But William couldn't dismiss what he felt holding hands with family members at the meetings. His attendance became regular. Such sympathies put Crookes in the minority among his fellow rationalists in the Royal Society, probably a minority of one. Mindful of this, Crookes concealed his biases in 1870 when he announced that he had drawn up a scientific study of spiritualism, and most fellows of the Royal Society were delighted, assuming he would demolish the whole scene in his rowdy journal. Things did not turn out so neatly. After 3 years of chanting and summoning, Crookes published Notes of an Inquiry into the Phenomena Called Spiritual in 1874 in a journal he owned called the Quarterly Journal of Science. He compared himself to a traveler in exotic lands, a Marco Polo of the paranormal. But instead of attacking all the spiritualist mischief, levitation, phantoms, percussive sounds, luminous appearances, the rising of tables and chairs off the ground, he concluded that neither charlatanism nor mass hypnosis could explain, or at least not wholly explain, all he'd seen. It wasn't an uncritical endorsement, but Crookes did claim to find a residual of legitimate supernatural forces. Author's note: William Crookes had a mystical, pantheistic, Spinozistic view of nature, in which everything partakes of one sole kind of matter. This perhaps explains why he thought he could commune with ghosts and spirits, since he was part of the same material. If you think about it, though, this view is quite odd, since Crookes made a name for himself discovering new elements which, by definition, are different forms of matter. Coming from Crookes, even such tepid support shocked everyone in England, including spiritualists. Recovering quickly, they began shouting hosannas about Crookes from the mountaintop. Even today, a few ghost hunters haul out his creaky paper as proof that smart people will come around to spiritualism if they approach it with an open mind. Crookes' fellows in the Royal Society were equally surprised, but rather more aghast. They argued that Crookes had been blinded by parlor tricks, swept up in crowd dynamics, and charmed by charismatic gurus. They also tore into the dubious scientific veneer he'd given his report. Crookes had recorded irrelevant data about the temperature and barometric pressure inside the medium's lair, for instance, as if immaterial beings wouldn't poke their heads out in inclement weather. More uncomfortably, former friends attacked Crookes' character, calling him a rube, a shill. If spiritualists sometimes cite Crookes today, a few scientists still cannot forgive him for enabling 135 years of New Agey BS. They even cite his work on the elements as proof he went crazy. When young, you see, Crookes had pioneered the study of selenium. Though an essential trace element in all animals, in humans the depletion of selenium in the bloodstream of AIDS patients is a fatally accurate harbinger of death, selenium is toxic in large doses. Ranchers know this well. If not watched carefully, their cattle will root out a prairie plant of the pea family known as loco weed, some varieties of which sponge up selenium from the soil. Cattle that munch on loco weed begin to stagger and stumble and develop fevers, sores, and anorexia, a suite of symptoms known as the blind staggers. Yet they enjoy the high. In the surest sign that selenium actually makes them go mad, cattle grow addicted to loco weed despite its awful side effects and eat it to the exclusion of anything else. It's animal meth. Some imaginative historians even pin Custer's loss at the Battle of Little Bighorn on his horses taking hits of loco before the battle. Overall, it's fitting that selenium comes from Selene, Greek for moon, which has links through Luna, Latin for moon, to lunatic, and lunacy. Given that toxicity, it might make sense to retroactively blame Crookes' delusions on selenium. Some inconvenient facts undermine that diagnosis, though. Selenium often attacks within a week. Crookes got goofy in early middle age, long after he'd stopped working with selenium. Plus, after decades of ranchers cursing out element 34 every time a cow stumbled, many biochemists now think that other chemicals in loco weed contribute just as much to the craziness and intoxication. Finally, in a clinching clue, Crookes' beard never fell out, a classic symptom of selenosis. A full beard also argues against his being driven mad, as some have suggested, by another depilatory on the periodic table, the poisoner's poison, thallium. Crookes discovered thallium at age 26, a finding that almost ensured his election to the Royal Society, and continued to play with it in his lab for a decade. But he never inhaled enough even to lose his whiskers. Besides, would someone ravished by thallium or selenium retain such a sharp mind into old age? Crookes actually withdrew from spiritualist circles after 1874, rededicating himself to science, and major discoveries lay ahead. He was the first to suggest the existence of isotopes. He built vital new scientific equipment and confirmed the presence of helium in rocks, its first detection on Earth. In 1897, the newly knighted Sir William dove into radioactivity, even discovering, though without realizing it, the element protactinium in 1900. No, the best explanation for Crookes's lapse into spiritualism is psychological. Ruined by grief for his brother, he succumbed, avant la lettre, to pathological science. In explaining what pathological science is, it's best to clear up any misconceptions about that loaded word, pathological, and explain up front what pathological science is not. It's not fraud, since the adherents of a pathological science believe they're right, if only everyone else could see it. It's not pseudoscience, like Freudianism and Marxism, fields that poach on the imprimatur of science yet shun the rigors of the scientific method. It's also not politicized science, like Lyshenkoism, where people swear allegiance to a false science because of threats or a skewed ideology. Finally, it's not general clinical madness or merely deranged belief. It's a particular madness, a meticulous and scientifically informed delusion. Pathological scientists pick out a marginal and unlikely phenomenon that appeals to them for whatever reason and bring all their scientific acumen to proving its existence. But the game is rigged from the start. Their science serves only the deeper emotional need to believe in something. Spiritualism per se isn't a pathological science, but it became so in Crookes' hands because of his careful experiments and the scientific trimmings he gave the experiments. And actually, pathological science doesn't always spring from fringe fields. It also thrives in legitimate but speculative fields where data and evidence are scarce and hard to interpret. For example, the branch of paleontology concerned with reconstructing dinosaurs and other extinct creatures provides another great case study in pathological science. At some level, of course, we don't know squat about extinct creatures. A whole skeleton is a rare find, and soft tissue impressions are vanishingly rare. A joke among people who reconstruct paleofauna is that if elephants had gone extinct way back when, anyone who dug up a mammoth skeleton today would conjure up a giant hamster with tusks, not a woolly pachyderm with a trunk. We'd know just as little about the glories of other animals as well. Stripes, wattles, lips, pot bellies, belly buttons, snouts, gizzards, four-chambered stomachs, and humps, not to mention their eyebrows, buttocks, toenails, cheeks, tongues, and nipples. Nevertheless, by comparing the grooves and depressions on fossilized bones with modern creatures' bones, a trained eye can figure out the musculature, enervation, size, gait, dentition, and even mating habits of extinct species. Paleontologists just have to be careful about extrapolating too far. A pathological science takes advantage of that caution. Basically, its believers use the ambiguity about evidence as evidence, claiming that scientists don't know everything and therefore there's room for my pet theory too. That's exactly what happened with manganese and the megalodon. This story starts in 1873 when the research vessel HMS Challenger set out from England to explore the Pacific Ocean. In a wonderfully low-tech setup, the crew dropped overboard huge buckets tied to ropes 3 miles long and dredged the ocean floor. In addition to fantastical fish and other critters, they hauled up dozens upon dozens of spherical rocks shaped like fossilized potatoes, and also fat, solid, mineralized ice cream cones. These hunks, mostly manganese, appeared all over the seabed in every part of the ocean, meaning there had to be untold billions of them scattered around the world. That was the first surprise. The second took place when the crew cracked open the cones. The manganese had formed itself around giant shark teeth. The biggest, most pituitarily freakish shark teeth today run about 2.5 inches max. The manganese-covered teeth stretched 5 or more inches, mouth talons capable of shattering bone like an axe. Using the same basic techniques as with dinosaur fossils, paleontologists determined, just from the teeth, that this Jaws 3, dubbed the Megalodon, grew to approximately 50 feet, weighed approximately 50 tons, and could swim approximately 50 miles per hour. It could probably close its mouth of 250 teeth with a megaton force, and it fed mostly on primitive whales in shallow tropical waters. It probably died out as its prey migrated permanently to colder, deeper waters, an environment that didn't suit its high metabolism and ravenous appetite. All fine science so far. The pathology started with the manganese. Author's note: in another strange link between the elements and psychology, Oliver Sacks notes in Awakenings that an overdose of manganese can damage the human brain and cause the same sort of Parkinson's disease that he treated in his hospital. It's a rare cause of Parkinson's, to be sure, and doctors don't quite understand why this element targets the brain instead of, like most toxic elements, going after other vital organs. Shark teeth litter the ocean floor because they're about the hardest biological substance known, the only part of shark carcasses that survive the crush of the deep ocean. Most sharks have cartilaginous skeletons. It's not clear why manganese, of all the dissolved metals in the ocean, galvanizes shark teeth, but scientists know roughly how quickly it accumulates, between 1/2 and 1.5 millimeters per millennium. From that rate, they have determined that the vast majority of recovered teeth date from at least 1.5 million years ago, meaning the megalodons probably died out around then. But, and here was the gap into which some people rushed, some megalodon teeth had mysteriously thin manganese plaque, about 11,000 years worth. Evolutionarily, that's an awfully short time. And really, what's to say scientists won't soon find one from 10,000 years ago, or 8,000 years ago, or later? You can see where this thinking leads. In the 1960s, a few enthusiasts with Jurassic Park imaginations grew convinced that rogue megalodons still lurk in the oceans. "Megalodon lives," they cried. And like rumors about Area 51 or the Kennedy assassination, the legend has never quite died. The most common tale is that megalodons have evolved to become deep-sea divers and now spend their days fighting krakens in the black depths. Reminiscent of Crook's phantoms, megalodons are supposed to be elusive, which gives people a convenient escape when pressed on why the giant sharks are so scarce nowadays. There's probably not a person alive who, deep down, doesn't hope that megalodons still haunt the seas. Unfortunately, the idea crumbles under scrutiny. Among other things, the teeth with thin layers of manganese were almost certainly torn up from old bedrock beneath the ocean floor, where they accumulated no manganese and exposed to water only recently. They're probably much older than 11,000 years. And although there have been eyewitness accounts of the beasts, they're all from sailors, notorious storytellers, and the megalodons in their stories vary maniacally in size and shape. One all-white Moby Dick shark stretched up to 300 feet long. Funny, though, no one thought to snap a picture. Overall, such stories, as with Crook's testimony about supernatural beings, depend on subjective interpretations, and without objective evidence, it's not plausible to conclude that megalodons, even a few of them, slipped through evolution's snares. But what really makes the ongoing hunt for megalodons pathological is that doubt from the establishment only deepens people's convictions. Instead of refuting the manganese findings, they counterattack with heroic tales of rebels, rogues who proved Squaresville's scientists wrong in the past. They invariably bring up the coelacanth, a primitive deep-sea fish once thought to have gone extinct 80 million years ago until it turned up in a fish market in South Africa in 1938. According to this logic, because scientists were wrong about the coelacanth, they might be wrong about the megalodon, too. And might is all the megalodon lovers need. For their theories about its survival aren't based on a preponderance of evidence, but on an emotional attachment. The hope, the need, for something fantastic to be true. There's probably no better example of such emotion than in the next case study, that all-time great pathological science, the Alamo for true believers, that seductress of futurists, that scientific hydra, cold fusion. Pons and Fleischmann. Fleischmann and Pons. It was supposed to be the greatest scientific duo since Watson and Crick, perhaps stretching back to Marie and Pierre Curie. Instead, their fame rotted into infamy. Now the names B. Stanley Pons and Martin Fleischmann evoke only, however unfairly, thoughts of imposters, swindlers, and cheats. The experiment that made and unmade Pons and Fleischmann was, so to speak, deceptively simple. The two chemists, headquartered at the University of Utah in 1989, placed a palladium electrode in a chamber of heavy water and turned on a current. Running a current through regular water will shock the H2O and produce hydrogen and oxygen gas. Something similar happened in the heavy water, except the hydrogen in heavy water has an extra neutron. So instead of normal hydrogen gas, H2 with two protons total, Pons and Fleischmann created molecules of hydrogen gas with two protons and two neutrons. What made the experiment special was the combination of heavy hydrogen with palladium, a whitish metal with one flabbergasting property. It can swallow 900 times its own volume of hydrogen gas. That's roughly equivalent to a 250-pound man swallowing a dozen African bull elephants and not gaining an inch on his waistline. Author's note, the bull-elephant calculation works as follows. According to the San Diego Zoo, the hugest elephant ever recorded weighed approximately 24,000 pounds. Humans and elephants are made of the same basic thing, water, so their densities are the same. To figure out the relative volume, if humans had the appetite of palladium, we can therefore just multiply the weight of a 250-pound man by 900 and divide that number, 225,000, by the weight of an elephant. That gives 9.4 elephants swallowed. But remember, that was the biggest elephant ever, standing 13 feet at the shoulders. The weight of a normal bull elephant is closer to 18,000 pounds, which gives about a dozen swallowed. And as the palladium electrode in the heavy water started to pack in hydrogen, Pons and Fleischmann's thermometers and other instruments spiked. The water got far warmer than it should have, than it could have, given the meager energy of the incoming current. Pons reported that during one really good spike, his superheated H2O burned a hole in a beaker, the lab bench beneath it, and the concrete floor beneath that. Or at least they got spikes. Sometimes. Overall, the experiment was erratic, and the same setup and trial runs didn't always produce the same results. But rather than nail down what was happening with the palladium, the two men let their fancies convince them they had discovered cold fusion. Fusion that didn't require the incredible temperatures and pressures of stars, but took place at room temperature. Because palladium could cram so much heavy hydrogen inside it, they guessed it somehow fused its protons and neutrons into helium, releasing gobs of energy in the process. Rather imprudently, Pons and Fleischmann called a press conference to announce their results, basically implying that the world's energy problems were over, cheaply and without pollution. And somewhat like palladium itself, the media swallowed the grandiose claim. It soon came out that another Utahan, physicist Stephen Jones, had pursued similar fusion experiments. Jones fell into the background, however, since he made more modest claims. Pons and Fleischmann became instant celebrities, and the momentum of public opinion appeared to sway even scientists. At an American Chemical Society meeting shortly after the announcement, the duo received a standing ovation. But there's some important context here. In applauding Fleischmann and Pons, many scientists were probably really thinking about superconductors. Until 1986, superconductors were thought to be flat-out impossible above minus 400 degrees Fahrenheit. Suddenly, two German researchers who would win the Nobel Prize in record time a year later discovered superconductors that worked above that temperature. Other teams jumped in and within a few months had discovered high-temperature yttrium superconductors that worked at minus 280 degrees Fahrenheit. The record today stands at minus 218 degrees Fahrenheit. The point is that many scientists who'd predicted the impossibility of such superconductors felt like asses. It was the physics equivalent to finding the coelacanth. And like megalodon romantics, cold fusion lovers in 1989 could point to the recent superconductor craziness and force normally dismissive scientists to suspend judgment. Indeed, cold fusion fanatics seemed giddy at the chance to overthrow old dogma, a delirium typical of pathological science. Still, a few skeptics, especially at Caltech, seethed. Cold fusion upset these men's scientific sensibilities, and Pons and Fleischmann's arrogance upset their modesty. The two had bypassed the normal peer review process in announcing results, and some considered them charlatans intent on enriching themselves, especially after they appealed directly to President George H.W. Bush for $25 million in immediate research funds. Pons and Fleischmann didn't help matters by refusing to answer as if such inquiries were insulting questions about their palladium apparatus and experimental protocol. They claimed they didn't want their ideas to be stolen, but it sure looked as if they were hiding something. Nevertheless, increasingly doubtful scientists across the world, except in Italy where yet another cold fusion claim popped up, learned enough from what the two men said to rig up their own palladium and heavy hydrogen experiments, and they began pummeling the Utah scientists with null results. A few weeks later, after perhaps the most concerted effort since Galileo to discredit, even disgrace, scientists, hundreds of chemists and physicists held what amounted to an anti-Pons and Fleischmann rally in Baltimore. They showed, embarrassingly, that the duo had overlooked experimental errors and used faulty measuring techniques. One scientist suggested that the two had let the hydrogen gas build up, and that their biggest fusion spikes were chemical explosions, a la the Hindenburg. The supposed fusion spike that burned holes in the table and bench happened overnight, when no one was around. Usually it takes years to root out scientific error, or at least to resolve a controversial question, but cold fusion was cold and dead within 40 days of the initial announcement. One wag who attended the conference summed up the brouhaha in biting, if unrhythmical, verse. Tens of millions of dollars at stake, dear brother, because some scientists put a thermometer at one place and not another. But psychologically interesting parts of the affair were still to come. The need to believe in clean, cheap energy for the whole world proved tenacious, and people could not still their heartstrings so quickly. At this point, the science mutated into something pathological. As with investigations into the paranormal, only a guru, the medium or Fleischmann and Pons, had the power to produce the key results, and only under contrived circumstances, never in the open. That didn't give pause to, and in fact only encouraged, cold fusion enthusiasts. For their part, Pons and Fleischmann never backed down, and their followers defended the two, not to mention themselves, as important rebels, the only people who got it. Some critics countered with their own experiments for a while after 1989, but cold fusionists always explained away any damning results, sometimes with more ingenuity than they showed in their original scientific work. So the critics eventually gave up. David Goodstein, a Caltech physicist, summed things up in an excellent essay on cold fusion. Because cold fusioners see themselves as a community under siege, there is little internal criticism. Experiments and theories tend to be accepted at face value, for fear of providing even more fuel for external critics, if anyone outside the group was bothering to listen. In these circumstances, crackpots flourish, making matters worse for those who believe that there is serious science going on here. It's hard to imagine a better, more concise description of pathological science. The most charitable explanation of what happened to Pons and Fleischmann is this. It seems unlikely they were charlatans who knew that cold fusion was bunkum but wanted a quick score. It wasn't 1789, where they could have just skedaddled and scammed the rubes in the next town over. They were going to get caught. Maybe they had doubts, but were blinded by ambition and wanted to see what it felt like to be brilliant in the world's eyes, even for a moment. Probably, though, these two men were just misled by a queer property of palladium. Even today, no one knows how palladium guzzles so much hydrogen. In a slight rehabilitation of Pons and Fleischmann's work, though not their interpretation of it, some scientists do think that something funny is going on in palladium heavy water experiments. Strange bubbles appear in the metal, and its atoms rearrange themselves in novel ways. Perhaps even some weak nuclear forces are involved. To their credit, Pons and Fleischmann pioneered this work. It's just not what they wanted to, or will, go down in science history for. Not every scientist with a touch of madness ends up drowning in pathological science, of course. Some, like Crookes, escape and go on to do great work. And then there are the rare cases where what seems like pathological science at the outset turns out to be legitimate. Wilhelm Röntgen tried his damnedest to prove himself wrong while pursuing a radical discovery about invisible rays, but couldn't. And because of his persistence and insistence on the scientific method, this mentally fragile scientist really did rewrite history. In November 1895, Röntgen was playing around in his laboratory in central Germany with a Crookes tube, an important new tool for studying subatomic phenomena. Named after its inventor, you know who, the Crookes tube consisted of an evacuated glass bulb with two metal plates inside at either end. Running a current between the plates caused a beam to leap across the vacuum, a crackle of light like something from a special effects lab. Scientists now know it's a beam of electrons, but in 1895, Röntgen and others were trying to figure that out. A colleague of Röntgen's had found that when he made a Crookes tube with a small aluminum foil window, reminiscent of the titanium window Per Ingvar Brandmark later welded onto rabbit bones, the beam would tunnel through the foil into the air. It died pretty quickly. Air was like poison to the beam, but it could light up a phosphorescent screen a few inches distant. A little neurotically, Röntgen insisted on repeating all his colleagues' experiments, no matter how minor. So he built this setup himself in 1895, but with some alterations. Instead of leaving his Crookes tube naked, he covered it with black paper so that the beam would escape only through the foil. And instead of the phosphorescent chemicals his colleague had used, he painted his plates with a luminescent barium compound. Accounts of what happened next vary. As Röntgen was running some tests, making sure his beam jumped between the plates properly, something caught his attention. Most accounts say it was a piece of cardboard coated with barium, which he'd propped on a nearby table. Other contemporary accounts say it was a piece of paper that a student had finger-painted with barium, playfully drawing the letter A or S. Regardless, Röntgen, who was colorblind, would have seen just a dance of white on the edge of his vision at first. But every time he turned the current on, the barium plate, or the letter, glowed. Röntgen confirmed that no light was escaping from the blackened Crookes tube. He'd been sitting in a dark lab, so sunshine couldn't have caused the sparkle either. But he also knew the Crookes beams couldn't survive long enough in air to jump over to the plate or letter. He later admitted he thought he was hallucinating. The tube was clearly the cause, but he knew of nothing that could warp through opaque black paper. So he propped up a barium-coated screen and put the nearest objects at hand, like a book, near the tube to block the beam. To his horrified amazement, an outline of a key he'd used as a bookmark appeared on the screen. He could somehow see through things. He tried objects in closed wooden boxes and saw through those, too. But the truly creepy, truly black magic moment came when he held up a plug of metal and saw the bones of his own hand. At this point, Rentgen ruled out mere hallucination. He assumed he'd gone stark mad. We can laugh today at his getting so worked up over discovering X-rays, but notice his remarkable attitude here. Instead of leaping to the convenient conclusion that he'd discovered something radically new, Rentgen assumed he'd made a mistake somewhere. Embarrassed and determined to prove himself wrong, he locked himself in his lab, isolating himself for 7 unrelenting weeks in his cave. He dismissed his assistants and took his meals grudgingly, gulping down food and grunting more than talking to his family. Unlike crooks or the megalodon hunters or pawns and fleischmen, Rentgen labored heroically to fit his findings in with known physics. He didn't want to be revolutionary. Ironically, though he did everything to skirt pathological science, Rentgen's papers show that he couldn't shake the thought he had gone mad. Moreover, his muttering and his uncharacteristic temper made other people question his sanity. He jokingly said to his wife, Bertha, "I'm doing work that will make people say old Rentgen has gone crazy." He was 50 then, and she must have wondered. Still, the Crookes tube lit up the barium plates every time, no matter how much he disbelieved. So Rentgen began documenting the phenomenon. Again, unlike the 3 previous pathological cases, he dismissed any fleeting or erratic effects, anything that might be considered subjective. He sought only objective results, like developed photographic plates. At last, slightly more confident, he brought Bertha into the lab one afternoon and exposed her hand to the X-rays. Upon seeing her bones, she freaked out, thinking it a premonition of her death. She refused to go back into his haunted lab after that, but her reaction brought immeasurable relief to Rentgen. Possibly the most loving thing Bertha ever did for him, it proved he hadn't imagined everything. At that point, Rentgen emerged, haggard, from his laboratory, and informed his colleagues across Europe about Rentgen rays. Naturally, they doubted him, just as they'd scorned Crookes and later scientists would scorn the megalodon and cold fusion. But Rentgen had been patient and modest, and every time someone objected, he countered by saying he'd already investigated that possibility until his colleagues had no more objections. And herein lies the uplifting side to the normally severe tales of pathological science. Scientists can be cruel to new ideas. One can imagine them asking, "What sort of mystery beams can fly invisibly through black paper, Wilhelm, and light up the bones in your body? Bah!" But when he fought back with solid proof, with repeatable experiments, most overthrew their old ideas to embrace his. Though a middling professor his whole life, Rentgen became every scientist's hero. In 1901, he won the inaugural Nobel Prize in Physics. 2 decades later, a physicist named Henry Moseley used the same basic X-ray setup to revolutionize the study of the periodic table. And people were still so smitten a century later that in 2004, the largest official element on the periodic table at the time, number 111, long called unanumium, became Rentgenium.